there's a great big unresolved mess in the midst of our foreign policy and our relationship with the world, which is this inconsistent role that we play in that. That while New Zealanders want us to go off and help with cyclones and poverty in other parts of the world, actually, simultaneously, while we do those things, helping the United States fight its wars and targets and people with drones and dusty parts of the world where New Zealanders have no enemies or reason to treat other people as enemies. It's a very, very curious situation and won't be resolved quickly because there are very big powers involved in it. But as a citizen, as people of New Zealand, we should be aware of this because the more people are aware of it and the more time that passes, the more impossible it becomes to stay there because it's just not what New Zealand is.
Kia ora, greetings and welcome to Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. On the phone from Wellington, I have Nikki Harger of NikkiHarger.info. And Nikki's New Zealand's foremost investigative journalist, covering topics such as intelligence networks, environmental issues, and politics, whose books have both illuminated and shocked readers across the country and globally, as we as a nation find out to our consternation that behind the news, the bureaucratic systems, and the political world, truth is hidden from the masses on a grand and vast scale. So, Nikki, kia ora.
Kia ora.
Nikki, you've authored 7 books which opened our closed eyes and continue to keep them open to this day. And as we near Christmas in 2018, can you say you feel sort of relaxed and well with a sense of some kind of peace and well-being?
I'm relieved to say that I feel peace and well-being most of the time, or I probably couldn't do my job. So yes I do, and my work for the year is nearly done, yes.
Oh, that's good, because, I mean, Christmas is a time of grace and a time of forgiveness, and we just trust that that actually enters the collective consciousness of New Zealanders and our global audience as well. Nikki, the reason why I brought this question up by you feeling secure in your home, that there was a police raid on your house in 2014, and then came an extraordinary apology from the police afterwards saying that they should not have done it and that they won't do it again. And you feel confident that your home is your castle?
I have to say, many people have the police come into their homes. Normally it's young people or people whose flatmates have used drugs or something like that. So I don't think I had a unique situation. But for everyone who it happens to, it's a very, very unpleasant thing. It hits you emotionally. It hit me emotionally in a way I didn't expect when they came here. And unlike most of those people who get their houses raided because their flatmates might be using drugs or whatever it is, and the horrible feelings that they have from that, I was lucky enough to have 3 really good lawyers who worked for years to get me an apology and the declaration that they'd acted unlawfully. So I don't see myself as the unlucky one. I see myself as the lucky one in this process, that lots of people deserve more justice than they get from the world. Normally justice costs more, or often it costs more than people can afford, even when they know that they've been wronged. So I was very lucky, and I hope I did it on behalf of other people too, to have various things that the police had done declared unlawful.
To have the support of 3 lawyers, it's a wonderful backup, because in mid-June 2018, you accepted an apology and compensation for substantial damages from the New Zealand police for raiding your home as part of the hacking that led to the Dirty Politics books, and the police also acknowledging accessing your financial records as part of the apology settlement. So when the police have to pay up in instances like this, where does their money come from?
To be honest, I don't know. It must be public money and police money, but I'm not sure quite how it works. And the point of the money, actually, like, it's good. I've jokingly called it the New Zealand Police Writers Fellowship for me. I'll put the money to good use. But I mean, some people could think, whoa, why does he get some public money? And the reason why, in a case like this, sticking at it and getting a payout is that otherwise words are cheap. They can say, oh, yes, we made some mistakes, you know, we will review our procedures or something. But that doesn't give very much confidence that next time they're in a similar situation, they won't do the same again. And what you want in a case like this is the people who are making the decisions think, that was really a big, horrible pain. We got a whole lot of trouble. We had that embarrassing payout we had to make. We had to say sorry for about 10 things in a row, which we normally never say sorry for. And if you get that kind of result, it means that there hopefully will be people in the future who say, well, we would like to raid that house and find out the source of that person's sources or some other political thing where they are being tempted to engage. And then they remember, Nikki Haga, we don't want to do that again. And so probably, my hope is that it makes it less likely for me and less likely for other people in future.
I would like to think so too. I was under the impression that if you're a taxi driver or a truck driver and you keep getting traffic fines for speeding, that the company doesn't pay, that you have to pay. So does this translate to possibly some of the higher-ups needing to take some money out of their salary and also put it to the substantial damages?
That's a very attractive idea, but I think you know the answer, which is that never would happen, or would virtually never happen. It will come from some fund, some contingency fund for things that go wrong, because they've probably been sued and getting in trouble various times a year, and they've budgeted for it, I'm afraid. But that doesn't mean that the higher-ups aren't being stung over something they actually care more about than money, probably, which is their good reputations and their sense that they're the right, they're the goodies. And if they have to apologise for making up stories when they're getting found someone's information, like they did with me, they made up that they were investigating me for fraud. It's embarrassing to have to say they made it up and it wasn't true, and that they didn't have legal basis for going after my bank accounts and all my other data from different companies. It's embarrassing to say you've acted unlawfully when you're supposedly the agents of the law, and so on. And of course, that it was unlawful to come and raid the house at all, and that they shouldn't have done it, and they broke their own rules and procedures. All of that has a powerful effect for at least a while on the senior people, and that's what made it worthwhile. Because frankly, 4 years of court case for something that never should have happened was quite a pain after a while. And the thing that kept me going was not the thought of the Writers' Fellowship, it was the thought that if I didn't do it, when I had three lawyers and I was in a position to fight it, then other people who didn't have three lawyers were more likely to get in trouble in the future. So it kind of felt this necessity to follow it to the end and get a strong result.
Yes, very good. And their promotions now would be looked at in a different light. And so what do you say about today, there seems to be a lack of quality journalism in New Zealand. Did you want to comment on this?
Yes, I'm happy to comment on that. But I don't want to join in saying there's a lack of quality journalism in New Zealand, because I think that would be unfair to the journalists.
Thank you.
So what I would say is, what everybody knows is that there are some news media in New Zealand, quite a few, whose quality has been dropping. Their quality has been dropping fast, and I think they're making a critical mistake in this. I think that the way you maintain public support for mass media is by being more, having higher quality and doing better work, not by doing silly clickbait kind of journalism. And most people in the media agree with that too. It's just this culture seemingly at the upper levels which say go down, go down, go down, and you've never gone down far enough. But that's not a criticism of the journalists, because I go to journalism schools every year. I know the kind of people who come into it. They're generally really good sorts who want to play a decent role in society and who care about the public's right to know. And while the news organizations they go into aren't always the most conducive place for doing everything they dreamed of doing, they're still doing their best. And some of them do really good work in spite of everything, kind of. For the sake of those people who are playing a really vital function for all of us, letting us know what's going on, which we need them to do, for their sake, I don't think people should say, journalists, oh, they're a rotten breed, I hate journalists and stuff. They should realise that they're doing a hard job in a strange, quickly changing environment economically, and that they're doing the best on it on the whole.
Yes, because I've noticed that mainstream media over the years has gone to sensationalism, and there's been a sort of a lack of in-depth. New Zealand Herald gone to a tabloid size, and I've noticed that, say, stuff.co.nz some years ago used to be, I think, the Dominion, has gone into a lot of clickbait stuff where their titillation has seemed to be a real important thing to them. And I even see this now happening in the New Zealand Herald to a degree. News media, if it's controlled from outside the country, we're not really getting a good understanding of what's happening at the grassroots in this country.
No, we're not. I mean, the fact is, I believe we are not. I actually wrote this a few years ago and I still believe it. I think we have well passed the point where the news media is not fulfilling its function in society. It's doing its best in places. It gives us the general things. But on many issues, I would say on most issues, there is not the kind of scrutiny that you need for things to go properly in a democratic society. There's definitely a big problem, and big problems need big solutions, and we haven't got the big solutions yet.
Very true. You're also the only, so far, the only New Zealand member of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. Their website is icij.org, icij.org. And I've just had a look at it, and it opens up on the Panama Papers and then also the Paradise. And when you look deeper and deeper, it's a gigantic rabbit hole of all the distortions and corruption and lies and secrecy going on in all the countries of our planet. It sort of takes your breath away.
Yes, of course, and that's why it's done. There's two sides to this. One is that, yes, there are really rotten things going on that need to be exposed to try and stop them. But when people read things like that, I hope that, like, would dig their way through the ICIJ website or something. I hope the effect of it isn't everything is stuffed, this is all hopeless, God, it's a rotten world.
Yes.
Because that's not why I do it, and that's not how it feels to me. Occasionally I work on subjects which are just truly, genuinely depressing, and I don't know how we get out of some hole or trouble. But mostly, the reason why people write the stories they do is not because they want to spread despair. They're doing it because they want things to be better, and they believe things can be better. And the reason why you expose the people who dodge tax on a massive basis and impoverish their little countries, or who are doing money laundering and corruption, is to stop it. It's not to say this is just inevitability and watch everybody, your world is a ghastly place. It's trying to make a different world. Trying to say there are plenty of people who, most people by far, pay their taxes, believe in social services, want to have a better world for other people, and a relatively small number of people can muck it up on a massive scale if they can do it secretly, unaccountably, no one ever knowing what they're doing. And that's where investigative journalism, as good journalism, is real, or I mean really in this context, that's where good journalism can make a big difference to the world. Because if people think that they can't necessarily get away with stuff, they don't say the same things and they don't do the same things. And so what I'm getting at is that investigative journalism could seem like a bad news machine to just tell us how bad everything is, but it's not meant to be that. It's meant to be, here is a vision of how the world can be better, and by pointing out the things that are wrong, it's supposed to be a saying what, how it can be right, and it's more of us than them, and we've got to do something about it because they're mucking it up for all of us.
I hear you, Nikki. I've travelled extensively myself, and I've come to the conclusion that 85 to 90% of the global population are essentially good human beings who just want to grow up, enjoy life, have a family, have a home, have a good job, and see the world and learn about life. And so we just have to, as you say, focus on what challenges there are and bring about the solution.
Yeah.
And can I ask, Wikipedia, I've donated numerous times to Wikipedia, and I like a lot of the historical stuff that has no bearing or meaning in today's life in these particular times. Do you find that when it comes to political stuff, it's factual and true? Because I know that certain entities will go on Wiki and change and edit the narrative, and I've heard of battles going on there.
Yeah. Wikipedia seemed like not necessarily a good idea when it started. It seemed a very optimistic idea that by many people who don't even know each other making contributions, you could have a marvellous online encyclopedia of many things. But it is mostly working. On many subjects, it's very useful,
yes,
I think. But it has distinct limitations, which is, I think, what you were raising. The first one, which I know, is you don't know who's written something sometimes. You don't know why someone's written something. And so in my work, I would never use Wikipedia as my source.
Yes.
I might look at the sources, the references at the bottom of a page. You know, like if there's a claimed figure, I'll then go down to the reference and see what the figure is, and maybe that will help me to get to some incidental figure that I need or fact I need for something in a hurry. But yes, what you find with Wikipedia is if it's talking about an area which is like water mechanics or something, probably, as long as there's been attention to it by enough people, it will be averaging towards correct. But if you get a disputed topic, if your topic is one where there are different sides and interests, and particularly if there are paid interests who want things to look a particular way, like PR people, then Wikipedia becomes less and less reliable, unfortunately. It means that the powerful people's Wikipedia pages are quite often kind of glowing because there's been so much attention given to them, unspecified people, or on disputed subjects, like really disputed issues. You can see that if one side's being inattentive of the issues, one side being inattentive, the other side will completely put its point of view there, and you won't be getting a balanced picture from it. So I think it's like all information. People who use Wikipedia, like people who use anything, need to be literate to what they're getting. It will be good in these instances. It will probably show organized bias in these situations. Good to find out references in a hurry from in these situations. And we can't use any sources uncritically, because we live in a world where not everybody is trying to tell the truth in an impartial way.
I hear you. The truth. Nikki, your first book was Secret Power, that you wrote back in 1996, and you were a whistleblower in relationship to the secrecy of the five English-speaking countries, basically beholden to the Anglo-American way of life. And this listening system called Echelon, and now dubbed Five Eyes, listens to all other countries' business, and you broke this news for the European Parliament. Can you just give a little appraisal of what happened there? Because you were bought in by the Europeans, as the Germans and French in particular were very upset that their communications were being intercepted.
Yeah, this is a funny old New Zealand story. So here's me, a kind of a new-on-the-scene researcher who's done my first big piece of work, and I had trouble getting it published in New Zealand because it was not being taken very seriously is the answer. But many authors have that experience. I wasn't special in that. And then the book came out, and it had the usual New Zealand approach to these things, which was about a half a day in the media and some denials, and then went dead. And I kind of thought to myself, oh, well, that was that 5 years' work.
Cool.
You know, that's not going to go very much further. And I managed to get one more TV documentary with John Campbell helping me from TV3 at the time. But it basically went dead. But before it completely went dead, I thought, I think I've got really important information here that people should know in other countries. So I wrote an article for an American intelligence journal, which was published, I can't remember, I think at the end of the year where the book had come out. Because I just thought, I bet some specialists out there will want to know what I found out, and they'll never hear about this book, which was in the New Zealand news for 5 minutes. So I'll just get it out there. And then I got on to other projects, because I published the article and nothing happened. And then I had one of the really strange experiences in my life, which is that article sat around for a year or so, and then it was discovered by a European Parliament researcher and stuck into a big report that they were doing on technologies, surveillance technologies, and technologies which impacted on the rights of European people. And I will never forget this, because from one day to the next, my phone started ringing. And I spent most of that year, which I think was 1998, doing interviews with newspapers and radios and TV documentary teams that were sent to New Zealand, piles of them. Like, it was the most international news I will ever make in my whole life times 10. So the thing which had been ignored here took off like crazy overseas, which, you know, was bewildering, sitting in my little house on a hill in Wellington. And really fantastic, because I knew I had really good information, but it was just the luck of how information sometimes spreads and bounces around. As a result of all that publicity, pressure came on the European Parliament, which is the parliament of, you know, Italians and Portuguese and Germans and British and the rest of it at that time. And they decided, and there were debates in some of the national parliaments of Europe. I mean, it's just amazing. It was barely mentioned in New Zealand. And in the end, they set up a special committee of the parliament. It was called the Temporary Committee on the Echelon System, I think it was called, some name like that. And so it was like New Zealand Select Committees on a large scale with numerous members running over, I think it was just a year, of hearings about whether or not it was true that the Europeans were being spied on by their supposed allies and neighbours, the United States and Britain, which they were being. And that committee decided that it was totally true. And in the course of that, I had this lucky experience of being able to go and be one of the expert witnesses for that committee. So I went to Brussels and sat in on the day before where a very, very well-known US writer on intelligence, Jim Bamford, was speaking. I mean, I've revered him for years. He's one of the main people who writes about that. And I listened to what was going on, and I thought, they're going to ask me questions about Echelon, and I can tell them the answer, but what I really think is needed here is to talk about what steps they take up to it. So I stayed up really late at the place I was staying and rewrote all my notes for it and gave a presentation there, which was really fun, in the European Parliament, about how the system worked and how I learned about it and how the different parts of the international network and allied countries fit into this worldwide spying system. And then I did the bit which I had done on the spur of the moment, which was saying, and therefore, if I was sitting in your shoes here as the MPs overseeing this, these are the things I would do for Europe. And then I went away again and left them to it. But over the next many months, they wrote this really amazing, never been anything like it in the world before, report on how to try to secure people's privacy in the era of digital communications and international surveillance systems like Echelon. And so it was a really important thing. But if you'll just let me talk for one moment more.
Sure.
There was this marvelous, kind of marvelous and terrible piece of history, which is that this never happened before, never would have happened somewhere else, never would have happened in New Zealand. We're far too embedded into those things. But this committee of all the countries in Europe came out with a unanimous report and recommendations on what should be done. Those recommendations were accepted by the whole of the European Parliament. And the date of that acceptance was in the first week of September 2001. And it seemed like a golden moment, and all around the world, people involved in human rights and digital rights and those kind of issues were rejoicing about this. Nothing like this had ever been done before. But that was an utterly fateful time, because this huge breakthrough in internet freedom and security happened just a few days before the September 11 attacks.
Yes, 9/11.
And so everything we had done was washed away for a very long time, like a little matchstick building in the way of a wave. It was just gone. So sometimes everything goes right, and then history rattles across the points and everything changes. But having said that, and then things come around again. So the war on terror years were obviously a really terrible time for human rights, and there was a large extent in the legitimacy and the powers of the intelligence agencies. But Edward Snowden came along talking about much the same systems that had been part of that Echelon debate, but by then much more sophisticated and extensive than had been going on when I was interviewing people. And that reignited it. We live in an era where we went round on a big detour of the war on terror years, but we're back. A lot of people take privacy and international surveillance seriously.
Yes, because, I mean, just a few years ago, German leader Angela Merkel's mobile phone was being constantly listened into, and the Germans just rolled over still.
What I would guess happened is that publicly, this is the world diplomacy, publicly they would have rolled over because they didn't want a huge dispute with the United States and Britain, but privately there would have been huge changes to their phone systems, I would guess. That's what I would suspect. Germany is a powerful enough country that they won't have just accepted it.
I trust so. Because in Oliver Stone's the movie Snowden, there were some very, very powerful things that came out. And I just want to quickly diverge. It showed all the gigantic screens, supposedly, in NSA headquarters, the National Security Agency headquarters, are all of the Eastern Mediterranean and focused on Syria. And you could see then the map of Syria and all the lights passing over communication networks in Syria, where you could see where from Damascus to Aleppo and everywhere else, all the lines of communication are open. And then the whole screen went dark, and all the NSA people in the States high-fived each other and said, guess what? We've taken Assad's communication systems down. And I thought to myself, but wasn't Syria a civil war between different groups there wanting to take down the Assad government? And yet America was totally involved in taking down Assad. They were actually infiltrating electronically and deviously to sabotage a independent country that had supposedly a so-called democratically elected government.
Yeah. Syria, like a series of countries in recent years, is this tragedy of a country which was destabilized by the Western allies. I'm afraid so. That's the story.
Yes, yes. Now, you mentioned John Campbell. I mean, dear John, I mean, I remember once seeing a TV program that he had, and he talked about a photographer in Wellington who happened to be at the Wellington airport, and he saw out the window a large US transport aeroplane. So he got out his camera and photographed the aeroplane, and then he blew the pictures up for enlarging them. He was able to look at the people who were climbing back on board, and he noticed James Clapper. And James Clapper was the NSA chief spy of our planet. He's the big top man of spy activities, was getting on board the plane. But until then, we didn't even know that he'd been in the country, and he'd obviously been down here with regard to Five Eyes or the Echelon Project. And John Campbell, at the moment, doesn't work for Campbell Live or TV3. And so it makes people wonder what happened there.
I don't think John Campbell's problems with TV3 were caused by the NSA or anything. I think they were caused by TV3. But what happened there, which is really worth talking about, is New Zealand is located in the south of the South Pacific. We, our nearest neighbours are Australia, obviously, but a number of little Pacific nations. And then there's a huge gap between us and the rest of the world. And it is a really bewildering thing that average New Zealanders like a nuclear-free country, want us to be involved in peacekeeping, don't like it when we go off to aggressive wars, want to have friendly relations with other countries, becomes increasingly Polynesian, more bicultural. While all of that's going on in New Zealand, we are, for historic reasons, in a few buildings and facilities around our landmass of New Zealand, part of the Five Eyes Alliance. It's a very strange, disjointed foreign policy. It doesn't actually make sense in the 21st century, but it's going on that for reasons of being English-speaking and an old British colony, we've ended up being one of the Five Eyes nations. It means that when Snowden was leaking this stuff, which was essentially about what the Americans were doing, and sometimes Americans and British, the code across the bottom would say, which was saying, who's allowed to see this document, would say, releasable to US, UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. And there was New Zealand, this little Polynesian country, part of the biggest intelligence system in the world for controlling other countries and managing wars and starting wars. And I mean, it's a quite staggering, confusing place for New Zealand to be, I think. And it's mainly dealt with down through the years by not talking about it, not commenting on it, not governments not reacting on it, keeping it secret, trying not to have it discussed. But as soon as we discuss it, we really should all just shake our heads and wonder that something so dissonant and unrelated to who we are as a country on the whole is able to go on year by year. And I think, personally, I mean, this is why I wrote about these things. I wrote that first book, which we talked about, is that there's a great big unresolved mess in the midst of our foreign policy and our relationship with the world, which is this inconsistent role that we play in that. That while New Zealanders want us to go off and help with cyclones and poverty in other parts of the world, actually, simultaneously, while we do those things, helping the United States fight its wars and targets and people with drones and dusty parts of the world where New Zealanders have no enemies or reason to treat other people as enemies. It's a very, very curious situation and won't be resolved quickly because there are very big powers involved in it. But as the citizens, as people of New Zealand, we should be aware of this because the more people are aware of it and the more time that passes, the more impossible it becomes to stay there because it's just not what New Zealand is.
Yes, Paul Buchanan, the local security researcher here in New Zealand, he talks about that New Zealand's got a schizophrenic foreign policy because we have the Americans as part of our defence relationship, but we have so much focus on trade with China, and you can see this incredible twist.
Yeah, and we assume, what I would say is, we're in an unstable time of change. And if you ask the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, for example, they would say, we have got a sensible, New Zealand-focused, nuanced, you know, balancing of our different roles in the world, and we've got the perfect foreign policy that suits all our interests, which is understandable that they say that, but I think it's hogwash. I think what is actually going on is that we are in the middle of a process of change. Part of it's decolonization, part of it is facing up to how we sell products in the world and earn a living to support the population here. We've got all these things going on. We're not in a nuanced position. We're right in the middle of it. Nobody's figured out how we have a relationship with China, which doesn't turn us into a repressive state. No one's really figured that out properly, and they haven't worked on it properly, and they're scared of those issues in foreign affairs and not resolved. We haven't figured out how we maintain our relationship with the United States, given what it's doing around the world and how different our values and our outlook is on many things. And so I think we've got a foreign policy made of all kinds of incoherences that aren't being faced up to and over time will have to be faced up to, which is why I say we're in the middle of a period of change.
It is. It's interesting because I was very much involved with the nuclear-free movement in New Zealand and kept an eye on it, and to a degree I was involved with many different groups. And when New Zealand became nuclear-free, it was solely because we had so many nuclear-free zones in this country, around about, I don't know, 105 nuclear-free zones, that it worked out around about 76% of the country was nuclear-free, which gave the mandate to David Longley and the Labor Party as the New Zealand Prime Minister to then enact the laws to make New Zealand a nuclear-free country. So from a democratic point of view, the people got involved and we shifted the game plan so that it was seen as a democratic way of resolving a situation. But what I want to just throw in here quickly is that when this happened, up in America, there were New Zealand armed forces up there, and they got shunned by the Americans straight away. And I heard of New Zealand Army servicemen who were walking along corridors in certain army or military buildings in the United States, and an American armed service person would see this Kiwi guy walking along towards them, and they would open up the first door along the corridor, go in and wait for the Kiwi guy to walk past, and then once the New Zealand had gone past, they'd come out their door and keep on going to the direction that they needed to go. They essentially froze out a lot of the servicemen, where in actual fact, when you are a warrior, and it doesn't matter what country you belong to, a person who is a warrior who defends their country does it appropriately with honour, and they want to keep their men alive. They don't want to do any horrible things, but they want to do it in line with some sort of military code. And yet the poor old New Zealand servicemen who were having to fulfil the needs of the country's democratic vote or process had to take the hit on that one, when what the Americans should have done is gone up, shook the hands of the Kiwis and says, well, we like working with you. We like being deployed with you, but the democracy of your country said you cannot be involved with us, and so thank you for being who you are, warrior that you are, and left it at that, as friends. That was unfair that our military men were picked on like this, to the degree that when the New Zealand frigate HMNZS Te Kaha and the tanker HMNZS Endeavour took part in the recent RIMPAC, or the world's biggest military operation up in Hawaii, that while the old enemies of Japan and Russia were allowed to stay in Pearl Harbor, the New Zealand ships were sent to Aloha Tower, which is a commercial area deep in the heart of Honolulu. We were again given a caning by the US establishment, even though we were brought into the RIMPAC exercises. The Japanese who bombed Pearl Harbor were able to park their ships there. It was like New Zealand was a naughty boy, so we're going to show you who's the boss.
I think it was that there was some genuine, probably there was some genuine anger in the US, particularly in the Navy, because someone told their ships that they couldn't go somewhere, and they're very fierce about that. But yes, I think it was a tactic. I think there was a tactic went on, this is now back in the 80s, but I think there was a tactic which was to make the New Zealand military people feel left out and bad and punished. But that wasn't punishment for the sake of punishment. That was punishment for the sake of getting them to do what they wanted, which was to try to change the nuclear-free policy, which didn't work, and then to get them to downside and align the New Zealand military as much as possible to serving the American-led militaries. And so I think it was a deliberate tactic to put pressure on the military people, who would then put pressure on the New Zealand government because of their discomfort. Yeah.
Yes, well, thank you for that. Yes, it's a big one. I'm speaking with Nikki Hager of nikkihager.info. Now, I want to be able to just swing over to your book, Seeds of Distrust. And I've been involved a lot with the GE debate and genetic modification. And even though you did say that in your book that it wasn't actually about contamination, it was about officials succumbing to an industry lobbying, quietly changing the regulations to allow contaminated crops to be grown here and managed by politicians by keeping the incident secret.
Yes.
The book is not about corn, but about political management. Well, I've been in touch with people here, and they definitely say that there has been a lot of tonnage of GE food coming into New Zealand, brought in. There's been 168,000 tonnes of GE soybeans brought into New Zealand over the last, say, 6 years, and given to pigs and chickens. And there's also a lot of GE dried distillers grain from the ethanol industry in the US that, because China no longer accepted it, it has been bought in, and it's been able to get through the border security into New Zealand, and there doesn't seem to be any pushback at all. Do you know anything about this?
No, I haven't heard about either of those instances. My head's been on other subjects. I'm not surprised. We do have a small country problem in a big world, which is that if our big trading partners and if some of the big agricultural countries like the United States have extensive genetically engineered crops, it takes real diligence by New Zealand not to get drawn into that. And that's what happened back in that book, was that New Zealand had a law that said, no, there will be no genetic engineering here, no genetically engineered corn crops. But because our seed sources for the sweetest and the biggest corn and things, the best strains, were coming from the United States, I mean the best varieties were coming from the United States, they had a problem that occurred in many countries, which was that some genetically engineered seeds were getting mixed in because they didn't care very much in the States. They weren't worried about it, so they weren't being scrupulously careful about separating the genetically engineered from the non-genetically engineered corn. I think at the time I got a lot of flak for that book, but from then on, pretty much up to the present, there's been much greater care about seeds which are brought into the country for planting and for growing in our fields, as far as I know. In other words, as far as I know, the people who were campaigning at that time on genetically engineered food and the effect of that book were positive. They've meant that we don't drive through field after field and plains full of genetically engineered crops in New Zealand. So we had a success, but no success is absolute. There's always new things coming around the corner, and what you're talking about is something else that needs to be addressed again. It's the same old issues coming around in new guises that have to be confronted again.
Thank you. Yes, I've shared this with Stephen Browning when he worked with the Greens, and he had a lot of challenges there, even getting his whole Green Party to be involved with this, because there's just so many issues of the day. And I drove down to Wellington about 3 months ago, and I noticed a lot of paddocks, particularly in the Hawke's Bay region, were orange. And I found out that they're all being sprayed with glyphosate. And when we get down into the microorganisms and the bacteria and the fungi, we're finding out that glyphosate is not here for the benefit of the human race or any organism. And so my concern is that I've got it from a person who's a veterinarian, a vet, who says there, but he's noticing that farmers who want to clear land just before springtime, they will actually spray the whole paddock with glyphosate, and they can allow cows 4 days later to come in and eat that, and that's allowed. And then on top of that, no one's testing for glyphosate in milk. And so this is huge for New Zealand. I mean, we have got a gigantic shadow over us in relationship to our dairy products going overseas. And I can back this up, a lot of data, but we haven't yet tested for glyphosate in food, other than the fact that you would have heard that about 34 Green MPs throughout the European Parliament from about 13 different Green parties were tested for glyphosate in their urine, and every single one was up to 3 times the allowable amount of glyphosate in their urine. So we're walking time bombs, and I'm sorry that I'm having to bring this up, Nikki, whilst I'm interviewing you, but I know that you also could pull in a larger audience to want to know how you see life at the moment. So I'm dropping this one in because it's in a very, very important issue, particularly for the future of our dairy industry, our exports, our children, the health of the human family.
What I would say about that is, it's one of the many things that we face, and like many things, we can't rely that the news media will do it by itself or that the government agencies will do it by themselves. It's not, but people can do this. And we were talking about the genetic engineering, anti-genetic engineering movement of the early 2000s. It was profoundly successful. And I just want to say a little word about this, because I wrote that book about that, and I knew people who were involved in it, And their feeling at the time was that they had been defeated, that they had pushed for a duty-free New Zealand and they lost. Which actually, I think that was a really unfortunate message for them to take from it, because the, you know, the nearly two decades since then have shown how much their work changed thinking and what was acceptable in this country, and we live with the results of it in terms of genetic engineering. And it will be the same for the people who organise on other issues like the one you're talking about. It doesn't take many people, if people listen to you on that and they want to take action on it, there are things that can be done. We do live in a piece of the world where organised people can make a difference to what happens. So I would just say there's always more fights, and that's another one that needs to be taken on.
Yeah, thank you for that appraisal, that balanced appraisal, Nikki. Because I've been involved in many other wanting to make... Northland now has become GE-free. We've had to battle it. We've had to do lots of submissions. We've had to go in and talk to different councillors and God knows what else. There are a good core of people, very, very small, constantly on it. And I know that in the Hastings area, they're wanting to be GE-free solely because the Hastings Hawke's Bay area is a very fertile area for good quality organic food, and so I can understand that, yes. Now, just one of the interesting things that I used to fly for Air New Zealand as a cabin attendant, and I used to work in first class, and often I would have the New Zealand round table of businessmen flying between Auckland and Sydney, or maybe Auckland and Melbourne, and we'd serve the first-class meal, breakfast, champagne breakfast, and they'd have six or seven or eight courses. And it was good, high-quality Air New Zealand service. But when, after about an hour, the aeroplane is in international waters. It's something like about, 500, 700, 800 Ks out into the Tasman Sea. And the round table would get up and they'd walk around, talk to each other. Now, we're in international waters. Are they allowed to talk about all sorts of deals? And I'm not saying insider trading, but if they're not in New Zealand and they're not in Australia, I always wondered that question. I wonder what they are allowed to share among each other from the standpoint of tips or assistance or helping each other. This must be a worldwide problem with people flying everywhere now and having meetings so that they can work out deals.
I have to say, I don't know the answer. I don't have the specialties for that. But my assumption is, if I had to guess, I would have thought it's not as you're saying. I think that probably their obligations go with them wherever they go. But I could be wrong. I'm not sure.
That's true. Well,
it doesn't mean they stick to them, but I would imagine their obligations go wherever they go.
Well, I'd like to think so, yes, because businessmen being businessmen. Now, I'm going to just come back on one other small thing here that I have. Oh, yeah, Hit and Run, your book with John Stevenson. Why is it that our SAS, Special Service Forces, are used in Afghanistan? Is it because they are really, really good at what they do, possibly better than the US SEALs, or because the US SEALs and the US military are so overstretched in their worldwide network or of bases, etc., that the Kiwi soldiers are the best that they can get and we're good at what we do?
There's a few different parts to the answer on that. One is that the New Zealand military claims to be concerned about peacekeeping and fisheries patrol and Christchurch emergencies and things. But there are people in the senior ranks who firmly believe that what matters is fighting alongside their Anglo-Saxon allies, Britain, United States, Canada, Australia. And so they look for opportunities to do that. And so there's an active push from the New Zealand military to have certain capabilities, a frigate to send to the Persian Gulf, an aircraft to send to the Middle East to move supplies, to have particular packages that they can offer when they're wanting to show their support and their involvement and show the New Zealand flag in foreign conflicts. And so in one way, that when the New Zealand SAS is sent, it's a convenient, easily slotted in capability to give for diplomatic purposes. So that's the first reason that they go. The next reason why they go and why they were in Afghanistan is that the SAS itself really wanted to go and actually lobbied to that effect. So I've written about this. The head of the SAS at the time went off to the Special Forces, US Special Forces Command in Florida and lobbied to be allowed to be part of it, to find a role for them so they could be part of the war in Afghanistan. So it wasn't like the Americans were begging us to have special forces there. It was that they really, really wanted to be part of it. So that's another dimension of it, and that's the sort of political agendas of the SAS itself, which I personally think is a worrying part of having that kind of capability, because it's kind of made for faraway wars where New Zealanders would usually not think we should be involved. And the last reason that the SAS were in Afghanistan was that although New Zealand could easily not have been there and we were kind of didn't matter very much, after a while after the invasion of Afghanistan and the setting up of American military bases all across Afghanistan, the Americans lost interest in Afghanistan. And all their attention went to launching an invasion and then trying to stabilize things in Iraq. And so inside Afghanistan, there were all sorts of places, which bases and things which had been, roles which had been run by Americans, where the Americans were busy. They wanted to go off to their new war in Iraq. And so they asked countries like New Zealand, but they asked every country basically, every vaguely allied country was asked to help fill gaps. This is 2003, 2004, 2005, a while after we'd gone there anyway. But now they were asking us to turn up and make contributions, basically to fill in for American forces to free them up to go and fight in Iraq. And so that was the last reason that some deployments by New Zealanders were that freeing up US troops kind of reasons.
Now, following the formation of a New Labour, New Zealand First Greens coalition government in the 2017 general election, the government announced that they're going to actually have an inquiry into your book, Hit and Run, with John Stevenson. And this is still ongoing.
This was a bit of a miracle, really. The New Zealand military usually only ever investigates itself, and it really strictly tries to keep it that way. If something goes wrong, if a plane crashes, if there's a dispute about something, or some people would be making complaints about sexual assaults or something like that, they nearly always do it internally. But we argued that the stuff that we'd written about in the book, this accidental death and injury to women and children and innocent farming fathers and things, was such a serious thing that needed an independent inquiry. And the national government, when the book came out, refused to do that. The Defence Force itself has lobbied very, very hard to try and avoid an inquiry. But what we have now is the first ever independent inquiry, in the history of our military into its activities in another country. So it's whatever comes of it, it's actually a really amazing thing that we have managed to have proper non-military scrutiny of the military. Because the first rule of militaries is that even if you think you need them, and that, of course, is a big if, but even if you think you need them to go off into the allied foreign wars, they need civilian control. Militaries need civilian control or you create a monster. And so it's really vital that it could be part of the way a country like ours works. If something goes wrong with the military when it's in other countries, that we as a country can test it, can check it, can look into what it did properly, can find out all the facts, because otherwise we don't have civilian control with the military, and that down that road are very ugly things.
Very true. Thank you. And we're nearly finished, Nikki. Has any information come to you regarding funding of political parties? Are we as transparent as they could be? Because, I mean, in your book, Hollow Man, we found out that a certain religious group were supporting one particular party.
Yeah.
Do you know if there's any more clarity regarding transparency?
I haven't done recent work digging into secret donations to find out whose they are, so I haven't got new information. But what I would say is that if I was asked to name my 5 or 10 most important things that the government could do to improve the integrity of the New Zealand government system and political system, it would be to change the election donation laws. It is like an organised, legitimised kind of corruption. It just makes no sense at all to have a country where you have a huge budget, like billions of dollars handled by the government, and you scrutinise that carefully, and then you fund your MPs in Parliament, and of course you do that because you don't want to do other work because it would compromise the workers' parliamentarians. We have the broad public service where we pay people so that they just work for the public. And then on the most crucial ingredient of that, which is choosing the government and choosing who sits in that parliament, we require the people to get privately funded for it. It makes no sense at all because it's not given in $1 and $2 coins at public meetings. It's given by big donors on the whole. And nearly all the big donors of all the major parties in New Zealand are secret. This is a totally ridiculous system. It's worth so little money, the difference between publicly funding election campaigns versus requiring them to be privately funded. But although it's sort of the populist, you know, talkback radio view would be, we don't want to fund those bastards to run their election campaigns, the reason you do it is the same reason that you pay MPs salaries, which is to try to keep the system clean. So yeah, I feel very strongly about that. I think it's like at the near the top of the list of things which have to change.
Yeah, thank you, yes. Imperative. It's strange that the two major parties, or even New Zealand First and the Greens, haven't broached this.
I think that the new government came in, there's two reasons for it, I think. The new government came in with an awful lot of really big problems and run-down social services and things. And so I think they've been fairly preoccupied. But the other reason is that the Helen Clark government in 2008 tried to change election donation laws, did change them, and took a huge hammering from an orchestrated campaign, from National Party activists. And they took a real hammering over that, and it helped them to lose that. Well, they're probably going to anyway, but it helped them to have a hard year when they lost the 2008 election. And so there, unfortunately, there's probably a bit of a memory around the Labour government that was not an issue that was easy to fight, unfortunately, because, as I say, I don't think it's a nice, or would be nice if we could do it. I think it's like one of those fundamentals that you do so that the political system works properly.
Excellent. Now, just in finishing, I'm an optimist. I still see that the possibilities of change in this country, and even in the end globally, that we're going to actually make the change that so that our children and grandchildren can really have a future to look forward to. Can you throw something else into this piece?
Certainly. I think that I've met lots of people who say to me, isn't the world kind of hopeless? Isn't it really stuffed? And they count off on their hands all the really big problems. And the truth is, there are really big problems. What I believe is, I'm part of a essentially optimistic profession, that you wouldn't do the work I do unless you thought things would get better. You don't want your life to be making people feel bad about things which are bad and will never change. So I work in my take on the world is that there are some things that we can't change, but there are most things that we could change and we can change, and which we do watch changing around us. And that the worst thing of all is when people start to believe that they can't change anything, because then they will be right. They will be proven right. So I'm an incorrigible optimist.
Good.
And I will stay that way. That's part of the job.
Excellent. Oh, Nicky, this has been wonderful. Thank you very much for coming and giving your valuable time to share for New Zealanders and the global audience as a whole. Greatly appreciate your insights, your courage, your sheer courage. And I want to say thank you again. I wish you a Pahutukawa Christmas, and 2019 be a real successful year for positive, optimistic change.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.
Excellent. Thank you.
Sure. All the best.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
That was Nicky Hager of nickyhager.info. nickyhager.info. I-N-F-O. Info. Well, dear listeners, we have come to the end of our year of 2018. I, along with Lisa Eyre and Liz Gunn, sincerely trust you've enjoyed our interviews and shared insights. Next year, in 2019, we'll endeavour to do interviews with more focus on solutions and what works, of people who are right out on the edge, innovating and creating methods and systems to make our biosphere more healthy, beyond strong sustainability, pushing regenerative natural systems, and looking at how we can rejuvenate the human spirit to recognise that when we all commit to work together and organise, we can move, if not mountains, mould matter. Though there appears so many seeming obstacles, we must trust that deep within our being resides an inexhaustible capacity to draw on the creative spirit of goodwill and cooperative endeavour. There's an old saying, when our backs are to the wall, this is when we get really serious and cooperate together and collaborate as one. We also have to remember we have been bequeathed a profoundly fertile planet that has embedded over the web of life an atmospheric bubble that supplies us freely with oxygen that keeps all biota alive. Rainfall that nourishes a dynamic food chain that is not only tasty but has juicy and sweet fruit. This has all been here for eons, long before we took our first breath. The question is that if life can give life, what is it that we do in reciprocity? The fact that the ancient Greeks around 2,500 years ago intuitively were aware that Mother Earth was a living organism or living entity whom they called Gaia gives us cause to wonder why we have forgotten our connection from a planet that lends us a body in which to exist. New Zealand Maori in this country of Aotearoa instinctively know that Papatuanuku is alive and sustains them. They have a growing connection to their great sustainer. Yet science today is only slowly recognizing that this is a fact. Yet for reasons unknown, it has in so many cases only been felt by many of the astronauts and cosmonauts who spent time in near-Earth orbit or even further out from the distance of the moon and realized the sheer beauty of this blue and white pearl floating in space as our only home. From their standpoint, they concluded that we were and are the family of humanity and that it was important for us to reconcile our differences and resolve our challenges and live together in peace. That was around 50 years ago, and still we have not established the diplomatic and conflict resolution skills to settle our differences. The imperative today now is for all adults in every country to look their children in the eye and commit to a grassroots movement of citizen diplomacy, whilst at the same time lean on civic leaders to call out political leaders to listen to the people. Sometime next year in 2019, we will have the planetary population hit 7.7 billion human souls sharing breath. So we have to inspire ourselves to commit to a future of all children, and it has to include becoming more conscious to the degree that we need to still ourselves, connect to our heart, invoke unity consciousness. The imperative being is to start now. If not now, when? Decide to network. Use every letter you write, every conversation you have, every meeting you attend, every email you send, and remember, even Facebook, to tweet and to express your fundamental beliefs and dreams. Affirm to others the vision of the world you want. Network through thought. Network through action. Network through love. Network through the spirit. You are the center of a network. You are the center of the world. You are a free, immensely powerful source of life and goodness. Affirm it, spread it, radiate it. Think day and night about it, and you will see a miracle happen. The greatness of your own life in a world of big powers, media and monopolies, but of 7.6 billion individuals, networking is the new freedom, the new democracy, a new transparency, and a new form of wholeness and happiness. This originated by Dr. Robert Muller, Chancellor of the World Peace University in Costa Rica, Central America. This is Tim Lynch.
And Lisa Eyre.
And Liz Gunn.
In the spirit of Aroha, wishing you a wonderful Pohutukawa Christmas. We look forward to being with you next week at greenplanetfm.com. I say kia kaha and haere ura.